5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hey, this is DeRay, and welcome to Pod Save the People. On this episode, we have Shavar Jeffries, the leader of Democrats for Education Reform.
I believe choice is freedom. Low-income people, people of color, should always have choices. And I actually think, particularly for Black people, we know precisely what life looks like in the absence of choice. I just think as a fundamental first principle that we ought to expand options on a whole variety of different domains. Education is just one.
And then we have the news with me, Brittany Clinton Sam, as usual. This week, July 9th, Monday, July 9th, is my birthday. It's my Jesus year, my 33rd birthday. And I've been thinking a lot about like what my intention will be for the new year. And there's this quote that I keep coming back to. And the quote is, if it's meant for you, you won't have to beg for it. You will never have to sacrifice your dignity for your destiny. And I just keep thinking about that, that like the things that are meant for us are meant for us, which doesn't mean that we don't fight for things. It doesn't mean that we don't have desires and wishes and they won't push. But like, we won't have to beg for the things that we deserve or like sacrifice parts of ourselves for our destiny. And I'm trying to take that with me as I go into my Jesus year. So I wanted to offer that. Let's get to it.
Hey, y'all. It's the news. This is Brittany Packnett at Miss Pack Yeti on all social media.
And this is DeRay at DeRay, D-R-A-Y on Twitter.
And this is Clint Smith at Clint Smith III.
And this is Sam Sinyangwe at Sam Sway on Twitter.
So for those who've been following along, the World Cup is in its Final Four. By the time this airs, the games are on Tuesday and Wednesday. So yeah, Final Four, semifinals, England, France, Belgium, and Croatia. We were joking that it's unfortunate that so many teams from the Global South are no longer in the tournament and got knocked out early. It was hard to say goodbye to the African teams. It was hard to say goodbye to the South American teams. But if you watch the games, you probably look and you're like, man, I didn't realize France had that many Black people. I didn't realize England had that many Black people. I didn't realize Belgium had that many Black people. Trick is, they don't. But they do on the soccer field. And all these countries, man, all these countries, they like don't really like migrants until you put them on the soccer field. And then they get real hype. And they're like, we love you.
Until we can make you some money.
There it is.
Ain't that how that works?
DeRay, who you think gonna win the World Cup?
I know nothing about football. I mean, soccer. I know nothing about soccer. So, I'm not very helpful on this.
Well, for a bunch of Black women in New Orleans this week, it was a different kind of World Cup because it's Essence Fest. It's the biggest Essence Fest since Hurricane Katrina. So it obviously means incredible things for the city of New Orleans. But if you have never been to Essence Fest or heard of Essence Fest, I highly suggest that you watch the movie Girls Trip, which was centered around this festival. And I love it for so many reasons. It's such a Black festival, right? Because it's like very little of it is outdoors. It's like, hey, y'all, we paid a lot for these hairstyles. I don't want to get rained on, and I don't want to stand in mud. So we're going to be in the Superdome for the concerts, and we're going to be in the convention center where we hear from incredible women leaders like Maxine Waters and Mary J. Blige and my friend Alencia Johnson from Planned Parenthood, lots of awesome people. And the concerts every night have been epic. So last night we heard from Queen Latifah and Brandy and Salt-N-Pepa. And tonight we'll hear the purveyors of New Jack Swing. I met Taj from SWV last night and almost lost my mind. I mean, I'm just such a big fan. And the festival will close tonight with none other than the queen herself, Janet Jackson. And so shout out to the entire team at Essence and all of the organizations and companies that have made this such an impressive empowering place for Black women this weekend.
And shout out to New Orleans, best city in the world.
Woo-hoo. I've been to Essence Fest a couple times, and it is so incredible to see both the celebration of Black women, the celebration of like Black culture at such an incredible scale. And you know, the oldies but goodies have a lot of sway here at Essence Fest. You're like, I didn't even know that person was still alive who sung that one hit. But they are here at Essence Fest, and that is very exciting.
My piece of news is a new study that just got published a couple weeks ago called, the title is Police Killings and Their Spillover Effects on the Mental Health of Black Americans. So this study is fascinating because it looks at the impact that killings of unarmed Black people have on the Black population as a whole. In terms of mental health. So when we think about police violence, oftentimes we think about people who are directly impacted by it. So, you know, we know, for example, through the data that we've collected and other folks at Fatal Encounters and Killed by Police and us through Mapping Police Violence, that about 1,200 people are killed by police every year, and about 50,000 people are hospitalized with injuries caused by police every year. So those are people directly impacted. What this research does is extend that to actually look at the ways in which these police killings actually traumatize the entire community, whether or not you have personally been impacted by police violence. And what they find in matching up the data that we've collected at Mapping Police Violence, looking at the relationship between that database and the U.S. Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System, which is a survey of health, particularly mental health of Americans. And what they find is that in states where an unarmed Black person is killed by police, the Black population as a whole reports additional days of being in what they call poor mental health days. So this is when the person reported that their mental health was not good. Their bottom line finding is that police violence against unarmed Black Americans contributes 1.7 additional poor mental health days per person per year for Black folks. And so when you actually look at, you know, you compare this level of impact on mental health to other issues, it's really, really bad. So, you know, in total, the number of poor mental health days caused by police violence against Black folks is on par with, is slightly less than the total negative mental health impact of diabetes in the Black community, is the finding there. I bring this to the table because it speaks to the ways in which the trauma and the impact of police violence, sustained police violence in communities, can impact people who have not experienced police violence, but who nevertheless are impacted by the images, by the ways in which police violence continues to show up in our communities.
I'm so glad that you brought this up, Sam. First of all, it's a reminder of the importance of data. Had the work that our crew done around Mapping Police Violence not existed, there would not have been a broad database against which they could juxtapose the mental health data. And, you know, we have talked, especially lately, a lot about mental health. I and others have been very open about our struggles with it. And I haven't really talked about this particular aspect of it, but when I first found a therapist in 2014 during the height of the uprising, because I was in therapy all during the Ferguson uprising, I had to find someone who understood racial trauma and racial stress and with whom I could have those conversations. I needed to have a therapist who was culturally responsive and culturally competent and didn't just dismiss racial trauma as something that I made up. Not only would that have been problematic because I wouldn't have been able to process the racial trauma I was enduring on the streets of Ferguson every day and watching Black and brown people be gunned down by police across the country, it also would have doubled up on that trauma, because whenever marginalized people finally discuss our trauma, the invalidation of that trauma actually increases the trauma. I remember the days following the killings of Alton Sterling and Philando Castile, I couldn't get out of bed. I called into work. At the time, I was leading an entire nonprofit and had to tell people that I had to cancel my calls. And I was very honest with them as to why. And I also let other people who may have needed to do the same thing take that time. Similarly, as I have worked with folks who are working directly with Dreamers and the immigrant population, have given them the time off that they have needed to mentally recover to be able to do this work every single day. Being Black is not a burden. My country has made it one. And I am immensely proud to be who I am, and am continuously fighting for and looking forward to the day that my Blackness is no longer seen as a weapon, and that my Blackness is not weaponized against me to continuously hurt me.
One of the researchers who led the study did an interview with NPR and noted that they weren't telling people in Black communities specifically something that they didn't know. Like, they knew that this study was, that the findings weren't new to people in communities, so that was important to just put out. I'll read, though, what they did say. And the quote is, from the clinical side as a physician, these events really kind of show you that when something happens in a community, there's a trauma that is a pathology, meaning it's a true illness, and that health systems, community health centers, public health organizations can try to rally around people to make sure that people are okay and that we're treating the burden of disease that's there. So I think that's why it's useful to put numbers around something that many people have noted anecdotally, because it sharpens the case for action. And it also lets us know the scope of the problem and potentially how we need to address it. And I think that echoes back to like why we did Mad Police Violence and Campaign Zero, all that work in the beginning, and like why the data is really important. Because it does sharpen the case for action, that there are some things that we know to be true and the data just confirms it. There's some things that we think to be true and the data confirms it. There are other things that we don't even know to ask questions about, and the data helps us actually like move through. So you think about like what happens when the only way that we know if you got killed by a police officer in this country is from newspaper reports. It's sort of a wild, that we think that we're like undercounting people. When you read some of the interviews that the authors of this study have done since it came out, they actually have also said they think that they're underestimating the impact, given like how much we actually don't know about the violence of the policing communities. And I think this is a case study not just for the work around policing that we do, but also to show that there are places that need serious change or wholesale transformation, and there actually just isn't a ton of data out there that allows us to think about how to change it at scale.
About a month or so ago, the new lynching memorial and museum in Alabama opened up from the Equal Justice Initiative and Brian Stevenson, which has been an initiative long in the making. And Brittany went down and movingly wrote about it and spoke about it. And I have not had the opportunity to go yet, but I'm hoping to make it down there by the end of the summer. But part of what it has people thinking about, including this writer, Brenton Mock from City Lab, is this the way that we sort of, the nomenclature that we assign to certain phenomena in American history, right? So the Great Migration, for example, is this time period where millions of African Americans left the South in hopes of finding sanctuary and better opportunities in cities in the North. And the thing is, sometimes we talk about it in these passive terms, right? As if people just woke up and said, oh, well, it would be nice to live in Harlem instead of Jackson, or it would be nice to live in Chicago instead of Montgomery. And they just kind of like said, whoop-de-doo, let's hop on the train and see what that's like. But instead, and what happens is that then we don't understand it as, you know, these 30 or 40 years where like 6 to 7 million refugees like literally fled the South in response to the threat of racial terrorism, right? And while certain opportunities, you know, did present themselves when they got to these new cities, many of the people were simply escaping one sort of violence and then running into a different kind. So you might leave Mississippi and escape lynching in the Klan, but then you find yourself in Chicago being redlined out of your neighborhood and beaten by police. And even Dr. King talked about the sort of how he had never seen the sort of level of hostility and violence in that he saw in Chicago in any place in the South. And so Brenton makes a really interesting point. He's like, I don't even understand why we call it the Great Migration. We should call it something like the Great Massive Force Exodus, or something that more accurately captures the unique nature of the violence that these people were fleeing. And that, you know, Isabel Wilkerson, who wrote the preeminent book on the Great Migration, The Warmth of Other Suns, I just can't recommend it enough. One of the most important books, I think, that has been written in decades. And she agrees, right, that language doesn't really capture what Black folks were doing, and that Black folks were essentially seeking political asylum in their own country. And I think about this a lot, obviously, with everything that's going on at the border and the sort of the way that so many people from, they're not wholly analogous, you know, obviously they have their own sort of idiosyncrasies and unique manifestations and unique histories, but I think it is interesting to think about what we call and what we name things and how that impacts our sort of collective memory, our collective imagination, and the way that we understand and remember certain things happening. And I'm sort of curious how we'll remember and what we'll call this period of time in which, you know, people were seeking political asylum in the United States because of, again, violence that the United States sort of perpetuated in these countries. And if you haven't read or watched the documentary, The Harvest of Empire, I really recommend that as well to give a sense of like how U.S. intervention in Latin America shaped the immigration crisis. But that's all to say, I thought it was really fascinating. And it's interesting to think about what we call things and what we don't.
You know, I took my mother for the first time to the Blacksonian for her birthday a few weekends ago. And it so happened that my aunt, her sister, her only sister that does not also live in St. Louis, she lives in California, was in town with her husband. And so we were all able to go together. And we were standing in line to see Emmett Till's casket, which if you have not been to the museum or experienced that, is a particularly somber and gripping moment of the museum. But as we're standing in line, my Aunt Beverly starts to tell me about my grandfather's brother, who I had never heard about before. And it's because my grandfather's brother was essentially accused of the same thing that Emmett Till was accused of when he was killed, of speaking to a white woman in some kind of way that white men deemed inappropriate or unacceptable. And he went home after being threatened by these white men, and my great-grandfather basically told my great-uncle that he had to leave and never turn back. Now, because of the era, chances are that his number was counted amongst the numbers that we consider and qualify as the Great Migration, but that was not a voluntary migration. That was a fleeing. My grandfather never saw his brother again until, like, for the rest of his life, because he had to hide out, and he never knew who was coming for him or what generation of those families that were somehow angered by his mere existence would come for him. And so they literally were disconnected for the rest of their lives. Again, that's not a migration, that's a fleeing for your life. And this is why language matters so much. And I really hadn't even considered it until I read this article, because what are we taught? We're taught the Great Migration. And I learned from, especially in elementary school, some very culturally responsive educators who made sure that our teachings on the Great Migration in second and third grade included explorations of things like Jacob Lawrence's migration series. Jacob Lawrence is, of course, a black painter who his most famous series actually explores what we refer to as the Great Migration. And yet, even in that culturally responsive context, no one questioned or interrogated the language. It is part of the reason why I and many others have been really adamant to remind people that phrases like "we're a nation of immigrants" actually really erases some people who were not voluntary immigrants, like those of us who are descendants of enslaved Africans, or people who are indigenous to this land, right? And there is a way that we can come together in solidarity and fight back against oppression altogether. Oppression against immigrants, oppression against indigenous people, against black people. We can do all of that without choosing words that erase people's entire identity. And I think this article about the Great Migration is another great reminder of that.
Clint, I'm happy that you talked about this notion of like the power of language. You know, I think often about the difference between punishment and consequence, and people use the terms interchangeably, but they mean very different things. And punishment is often about pain, consequences about change. And we have built systems that are meant to punish people. Like, it's not about any change. It's about just making sure they experience pain for whatever happened. It's one of the reasons why we no longer say police brutality, but we only say police violence, because brutality makes it seem episodic and sort of sporadic. Violence seems consistent to people. It's also why, you know, the police will say, like, you have to obey a lawful order. And we're like, well, just because you said it doesn't make it lawful, right? That, like, the legislature actually makes the law, you enforce them. So when you're giving out orders that are not based on things that the legislature has done, you're actually engaging in misconduct. And I even think about, like, if you Google, for those of you listening and Brittany Clinton Sam, like, if you Google New York Daily News and search for the word brute, it's fascinating because when the New York Daily News uses the word brute, it is, like, almost always a black person they're describing. So it's like the, you know, I'll just pull up this example. And it's like, and like, mind you, it's like people who've done bad things, right? It's like people who have, like, done bad things. But it's this dehumanizing language that is, like, really problematic. So, like, if you Google, literally, like, the headline is, like, brute stomps on victim. And then it's, like, brute. And it's, like, what are the circumstances where you call somebody a brute? Like, using, like, such dehumanizing language that they're, like, they're not a person who's been accused of something wrong. They're not a person who did something bad. Like, you've actually made them, like, less than human, some othering thing. And that's, like, that's still happening to this day. And, like, that actually changes the way that people think about the worth and value of other people. And we just need to be mindful of it. And I think you're right to bring this up as important news.
So I wish I had some positive news to add to this, but unfortunately I do not. There were some students who boldly and bravely stood up in Detroit and decided to actually sue their public schools based on the dismal conditions that they had been experiencing throughout their educational lifetime. Essentially, what they were saying was that because of overcrowded schools, a lack of basic resources like books and pencils, classrooms that were incredibly cold in the winter and incredibly hot in the summertime, and schools that were infested with rats and insects, that they had received an unequal education that had not prepared them for the world, including actually teaching them basic skills of literacy. This past Friday, a federal district court judge in Michigan actually decided to dismiss this class action lawsuit, basically saying that access to literacy, as they describe it, is not a guaranteed right. When he dismissed the suit, Judge Murphy actually said that the lawsuit itself failed to show that the state had practiced overt racial discrimination in not providing these basic skills and abilities. He did concede that the conditions at some Detroit schools were, quote, nothing short of devastating, but again, he threw out this case. The lawyers who are backing these students up are preparing to appeal, as they should. But it really led me to think about a couple of things. One, if access to literacy isn't a fundamental right, I don't know what is. We've had so many conversations in the public sphere around the preservation of public schools, around ensuring that students, irrespective of their background, their nation of origin, or their zip code, actually receive the kind of education that they deserve. And this seems like an incredible blow to that very notion, to that very idea that every single child, regardless of where they come from, deserves a great education. It also, though, made me think about Brown versus Board of Education. We've talked before about how much schools are segregated today. In fact, they are more segregated now than they were before that court ruling. And the holding of the court stated that separate was, of course, inherently unequal. Here's what they said. The court at that time said desegregation of children in public schools solely on the basis of race, even though the physical facilities and other tangible factors may be equal, deprive the children of the minority group of equal educational opportunities. We believe it does. In other words, what they were saying was even if all things are equal, the facilities are the same, the quality of instruction is the same, the resources that are provided are the same, that separate is still inherently unequal. So to me, it would follow that if separate is inherently unequal, even if all of the other physical factors are equal, when the physical factors are not equal, then most certainly this deprives young people who are living in marginalized and low-income circumstances. It would follow that children who are having to go to school while rats are crawling beneath their feet, children who have to put on blankets and wear multiple coats so that they can concentrate during the winter, children who are going to underfunded schools that don't even have the kind of books that they require in order to learn how to read, that is an abdication of our constitutional responsibility. And so I'm certainly disappointed by this court ruling. I am hopeful that the appeal is successful. I'm deeply proud of these students and families and communities that stood up to combat this. And at the end of the day, access to literacy and a quality education should be the right and is the right of every single child that we hold dear.
So I think this case really highlights a major flaw and gap in the construction of sort of what's considered a fundamental right in America compared to other countries. So the United States has one of the oldest constitutions in the world that's still in effect. And part of that, you know, we often hear that being talked about as, you know, a great thing because that means that it's sort of the longest stable system of governance and, you know, there are benefits to that. But there are also problems with it. And one of the problems is that it is one of the only constitutions in the world that does not include a fundamental right of education in it. So an analysis from a global ranking of education systems produced by Pearson, which is a publishing company, ranked the United States 17th place out of 40 countries in terms of the quality of its education system. And every single country that was ranked higher than the United States included in their constitution or in national law a fundamental right to basic education and literacy. The United States does not include that even to this day. So much so that the Constitute Project, which looks at national constitutions of countries all across the world, found that education is mentioned in 174 different countries' constitutions, almost every single country, as well as the term health or healthcare in 170 countries. But these are not featured in the United States Constitution. And so, you know, I think this is an example of a system that needs to be updated, a system that, you know, I think at the time of its creation did not really center education, healthcare, the right to vote, and so many things that are at least now considered something that should be a fundamental right throughout the world. But those are not embedded into our constitution or national law in a way that, frankly, it needs to be in order for us to catch up with the rest of the world.
My piece of news is about the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services Office. So there are two things that this office is doing that are both problematic that I feel like have not really been covered in the news mainstream. So they've opened up a new USCIS office in Southern California. And what they're going to do is review people's applications for green card status to see if they lied during the application process by potentially using multiple identities to defraud the government. So this is unprecedented because this is not like they didn't catch anybody. This isn't because there was some big scandal. This is literally the result of them trying to figure out how they can deport more people in a way that we've just never seen happen at this scale in the country before, which is sort of wild. So there's going to be a whole new pop-up office that just is going to review cases. And if they see that somebody lied according to whatever metrics they use, then they will key them up for deportation. So that is wild, and we should be mobilizing against that. The second thing they're doing, which is also really problematic, and I think about when I was a chief of human capital in Baltimore, we had a set of teachers who were from the Philippines or were from different countries, and we helped manage the immigration process as their employer. And traditionally what happens is when you're going through the process, and if you're denied at any step of the way, there's an appeals process, and you can loop back, and if you apply a change in status, so to go from one type of visa to a green card or something. If you apply for any type of status, it might be denied, and there's a process for dealing with the denial. What USCIS just announced on the 28th is that non-citizens who apply for a benefit and it's denied, they would be placed in deportation proceedings immediately. And it's that is just sort of wild. It's so wild that I don't even really have the language, but think about somebody wants to extend their visa and it just gets denied. They will automatically, immediately be put in deportation processes. No right to appeal, no due process. And that is just a lot of power to centralize in a department that we've not seen Congress make any attempt to provide real oversight. So I just wanted to bring that up as my piece of news this week.
So this makes me think a lot about the concept of margin for error and how the margin that you have to make a mistake changes dramatically depending on your identity and how the society values you. And so we see a process being set up here for immigrants to have essentially no margin for error. So, and not even their own error. So if you lie on an application, then you have no margin for error and you're just placed automatically in deportation proceedings. Or if you are trying to do everything right, you don't lie about anything, you go through the process, you apply for something, and for whatever reason, it's denied. Maybe somebody else who needed to corroborate something didn't reply in time, and you're still placed in deportation proceedings. So of nothing that you've actually done, you're automatically given absolutely no margin for error, even if you didn't even make an error, and you're thrown out of the country. Meanwhile, we see from this administration, whether it's Sarah Huckabee Sanders, whether it is Trump himself, whether it is the range of different people that this administration puts in front of us, routinely and pathologically lying to the American people with absolutely no consequences whatsoever. And I think that juxtaposition tells you everything that you need to know about injustice and inequity and the ways in which power strictly curtails what people can do if you are brown, if you are black in the society, if you're an immigrant, compared to if you are rich and white and have a position of power.
I've been having trouble determining exactly what I'm going to say without cursing. Because when we take this in the context of everything else that is happening, it is very clear to me that this is intentional and systematic. This is a place where I actually feel like the word, or the phrase rather, racial anxiety is appropriate and not just a euphemism where somebody should just say racist. To be clear, this is racist. I would be hard pressed to believe that the applications that are going to be called into question are going to be ones for mostly European immigrants. And I don't care who you are, you're gonna have a hard time convincing me of that. But my point though is that there has been a lot of anxiety by people who identify as white, non-Hispanic, and single race, right? So I'm not talking about people who are biracial or multiracial and one of those races they identify as white, or as people who are coming from Latin American countries or Spanish-speaking nations, but would be considered white, right? I'm talking about non-Hispanic, single-race white people. The narrative has been that those people are slowly, but actually not slowly, are quickly becoming outnumbered. To be very clear, people of color have always been the global majority, but the idea that people of color would be the American majority is something that has been reported on far and wide, and yes, has absolutely been causing a ton of racial anxiety for people who have been convinced that a racial outnumbering will mean their detriment, right? Now, there are plenty of us who have been outnumbered as Black people, as Latinx people, as AAPI people, as Native people in this country for decades, and we've somehow managed to survive just fine. But this racial anxiety has led to not just the kind of fear that helped elect this person and create this administration, but a lot of policies that we have to consider altogether. So we have been spending a lot of time talking about what is happening to new immigrants, those that are being detained and separated from their families, the ways in which asylum seekers are going to be pushed back from their ability to attain asylum, especially if they're coming from Central American countries. We talked about that last week on the pod. We also have talked about the fact that TPS holders, so people from Haiti and from the Sudan and other places who are fleeing persecution, that those waivers are being overturned. Now we're seeing that immigrants who have already been approved and are holding their green cards or their citizenship are going to be looked at all over again so that you can get rid of an existing population of immigrants. Then we already consider all of the ways in which Black and Brown and Native people in this country are being incarcerated far more than white people. And then when you add to that the travel ban on Black and Brown and Muslim countries, you cannot tell me that this is not intentional, that this is not systemic, and that this is not an all-out effort by this administration, this so-called president, and the people that support him to preserve a white nation. This country was never a white country. The First Nations that were here were indigenous to this land, and those people are not white. Indigenous people, people of color, Black folks, Latinx folks, Asian folks, Pacific Islanders, people in marginalized racial circumstances are feared by the people who are convinced that us existing will take away from them. I don't think this is an overstatement. I don't think this is an exaggeration. I don't think this is hyperbole. I think it would be silly of us not to proceed knowing that this is exactly what some people wanted.
That's the news.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Don't go anywhere. There's more to come.
And here's my conversation with Shavar Jeffries, the leader of Democrats for Education Reform.
Shavar, thanks so much for joining us today on Pod Save the People.
I'm happy to be here. Happy to be here. It's good to see you.
Now, you run Democrats for Education Reform. What is that for people that have no clue what that is?
Yeah, so Democrats for Education Reform, we're a policy and advocacy organization, and we exist at the intersection of traditional Democratic approaches to education policy, which is rooted in significant investments and focusing on education opportunity for low-income kids, kids of color, kids who speak English as a second language. So we support what Democrats traditionally have supported in terms of, you know, increased investments from the federal, state, and local level, civil rights commitment to making sure that, you know, getting all kids educated at a high level. But we also push for innovation and change, because particularly for low-income kids of color in too many cities, and frankly, even low-income white families in rural communities, public schools haven't worked at the level that they ought to. and some of the policy approach had been very stagnant. So we pushed for a variety of different innovations, from more differentiated professional development programs to support teacher prep, reimagining teacher prep. So it's not just a traditional schools of ed model, but allowing new providers to get into that space. We do a lot of work around accountability. So we worked on Race to the Top, work on ESSA. We believe in more choice and more options within the public sector. So not private or for-profit options, but public school options, both in the traditional district as well as in the public charter space. And then higher ed reform is big for us too. A lot of the work we've seen for the last 25 years in K-12, we need in higher ed. Many colleges are dropout factories for low-income kids, where kids are going into the debt, not graduating, not ready for their future, and have this oppressive debt on their back.
Now, there are a lot of people who, when they think about the ed reform space, it still feels pretty white and pretty focused on like the lip service about communities of color and not sort of the practice of communities of color. And when I've seen people sort of push deeper, it's been sort of like does the deeper staff sort of represent the communities that they say they serve? Like it was started by rich white people. Is this actually an organization committed to reform that will impact people of color in a in a deep way? So my question is, like, how do you conceive of the reform space? And I think about places like Colorado that you guys haven't had like a great sort of experience in. And how do you conceive of that space actually being rooted in something akin to equity and justice?
You know, I think the ed reform space, like so many spaces in the United States, has to wrestle, like any space in the United States, with white supremacy, you know, patriarchal notions. And this space is no different from any space. You pick any space in the United States, and these same issues of white supremacy, people of color not being empowered the way they need to be, is an issue. So I absolutely see that in the ed reform space. The organization I run under the leadership I have are committed fully to these issues. Our staff reflects that. Our work reflects that. The priorities we push reflect that. But there's no question. I mean, we've seen situations where ed reform folks, well-intentioned, oftentimes have come into communities, have sought to close schools, but did so in a way that wasn't in partnership with communities. We see too many charter schools, for example, not run by community-based people, not run by people of color. That's a problem. I do think we have seen also some important steps over the last maybe 3 to 5 years by stakeholders in ed reform space to invest more in community-based leadership, invest more in charters and other organizations run by folk of color. But this is America, right? So I'm not surprised that there's white supremacy in this space, just like I'm not surprised that when I worked with more traditional civil rights organizations, I saw white supremacy in that space. You know, this is an ongoing challenge that we have to call out wherever we see it. We do that. We don't support any charter school, for example, that's not operating at a high level. And even if you're operating at a high level, if we don't see people of color running it or in position of authority, we call that into question. And I think we have to continue to do that while at the same time acknowledging the important steps that have been made in this space. Because even despite some of the challenges, I've seen, you know, and the Credo study attests to this, that Black and Latino students in the largest cities in this country have been significantly benefited in terms of college attendance rates, college graduation rates, because of these reforms. But at the same time, we still have many issues that we got to address. We got to make some improvements.
The conversation about choice is like fraught in the ed space. And there's some people who say, you know, like, we don't need choice because if every school was great, then you wouldn't need choice because every school would be great. And I'd love to know, like, what your response is. Like, how do you defend choice when people on the left are against it?
My entry into this space is fighting for equity for Black people and from my community. And I use that as a space to expand to any population. I believe choice is freedom. And so I believe low-income people, people of color, should always have choices. And I actually think particularly for Black people, we know precisely what life looks like in the absence of choice. And so I just think as a fundamental first principle that we ought to expand options on a whole variety of different domains. Education is just one. Furthermore, we know that in many cities where Black and brown kids are disproportionately taught, the schools have not produced at a high level, which is precisely why people with money have moved out over 30, 40 years. Those who remain either send their kids to private schools or they have political connections so they can call the district and get their kids into the magnet schools or the better performing schools. It's actually only people who don't have choice who are the ones in the schools where only 1 in 10 kids are going to college. So to me, that's a fundamentally moral outrage. And so I'm very unapologetic by demanding more high quality. Now, high quality is the key, right? Because if it's not a quality option, it's really not a viable choice. And so to me, I can't see how anybody would want to argue credibly that black folks and low-income people and Latinos as well should have fewer choices, because in fact, everybody else already has choice. These are just the populations that seem not to.
Yeah, I think that makes sense to me from a policy perspective. I would push and say that, like, there are, like, parents and teachers who aren't convinced by that, right? Who would say things like, every school should be great, so why should there be, like, why should we create all these different sort of options for people? That is what sort of choice at its most basic element is. Yeah. And I want to know what you say to those people. I get what you just right. said to me is, like, what you'd say to, like, a policy person. That right. makes sense to me. Right. I get it. Like, that right. makes sense. But I'm not convinced, only because I've, like, heard people not be convinced right. by that. Like, that's that right. that actually sort of, I don't know, does anything to the way they think about choice. Or, like, how do you sell choice to, how would you, like, walk into a room of parents and talk to them about the importance of choice?
In an ideal world, the best situation is you have a school in your neighborhood that's easy for you to get to, right? So you don't have to send your kid, you know, long distances, that's accessible, that's operating at the highest level. That'd be ideal. Sadly, the reality is, and this is why I have to talk to parents and families, the reality is for many decades now, we haven't been able to get that done. And the question is, how much longer do you want to wait for your baby? And I have two kids myself. How much longer do you want to wait for your baby for them to get that together? And they've been for many decades, haven't gotten it. If we know a half a mile away, there's a school that's working right now. And I find that sort of message that we can get a better educational outcome for your child right now, while at the same time, so it's not an either or, it's not an abandonment. We still have to continue to push for accountability and reimagining teacher prep to get our best teachers in the most at-risk schools. We have to work with our union partners to make sure that the educators have the support they need, but also that we're holding folks accountable if they're not doing the right thing. So we still have to do that, but that doesn't mean you got to wait for all of that. Particularly, I argue to parents and families as well, they haven't earned the right for you to wait either. Right, they haven't given you a track record that should suggest you should give them more of the benefit of the doubt, even if that may mean that your child isn't ready for their future because they still can't work things out.
And what do you say in that same vein to the people who would use that sort of rationale to disagree with the ed reform movement? This idea that, like, we've sort of been in a reform state for 20 years mm-hmm. and we've tried everything. We did the small mm-hmm. school stuff. We did, like, we said that we're going to put the resources closest to the kids, and we're going to, like, have these innovative yeah. principal selection pipelines, and testing is going to be the thing. And, like, in most of the places, the outcomes have, like, if they've shifted at all, have shifted marginally, have not shifted in any way to match the level of investment
right.
that, like, the reform community has put in.
Right.
So what do we do? Like, what do we do in that context that, like, you know, it's like 20 years of really aggressive reform that hasn't really shown the outcomes.
Right. I mean, I probably push just a little bit. I mean, I think there's been some definitely incremental, you know, gain. So I would definitely agree that compared to the investment, I agree with you fully. Compared to the investment, we should have expected more. And so I think it's no question reform has to always reflect. I personally do think the whiteness of the reform space is part of the explanation for why it hasn't been as effective as it could be. You know, I think the idea, I mean, for example, in my city of Newark, we had folks coming in, you know, 28-year-old white kids from the Midwest dropping into the South Ward of Newark to open up schools, and middle-aged folk of color who have been educating kids at a high level for 10, 15 years who may not have been discernible to the ed reform people, who may have just been principals in these schools that the ed reform folks didn't know about. They, for whatever reason, couldn't get the access to resources to open up a school, but these young kids could. And they were still learning, and they were well-intentioned, and they still generated a lot of good because the traditional bureaucracy is, frankly, so broken. I actually think the benefits were largely a reflection of the fact that the traditional bureaucracy was so broken as compared to how I don't think the new people came in were all of that, to be clear. I think that just the traditional bureaucracy is so broken. But I think actually if we then invest and empower and create more opportunities for the people who have already been there and who are rooted and know these kids and families better, we'll see even better results. But I also think we have to reflect on some of these policies. I mean, the charter school innovation, I think, is very positive and good if the authorization is done the right way, right? If you have a proliferation of for-profits, lax authorization, it's very poor. And so many states are all over the map in terms of how that's done. We have a variety of different pipeline programs of varying degrees of effectiveness. I still continue to think the lack of high-quality teachers is just such a big constraint. So a big piece of our work now is reimagining teacher prep, getting more clinical-based approaches into the teacher prep space so we can get more educators who are ready to hit, ready to drive achievement from day one. So I think we have to, we'd have to take a hard look of what's worked, what hasn't worked, and then make the appropriate adjustments so we can hopefully get to a better level of outcomes.
Are there any things that you think we've done in the Everform space in the past sort of decade that not regret, but that like we did it and it just wasn't the thing?
The biggest thing I think that should be regretted, and I guess I wouldn't say we because I've been with D for 3 years. Before that, I was doing Everform work in my local community. But the biggest mistake that I think the Everform space has made is coming to entirely too many different communities, and not only partnering, but that the people in those communities need to own and drive everything that affects their kids, right? Period. So if it's a beautiful thing, it is an amazing thing that philanthropists and other stakeholders want to bring resources to low-income communities of color where there's a dearth of resources. That is amazing. We need people to keep doing that. People need to say, if I want to actually bring educational change to a Baltimore, to a Newark, to a Chicago, Philadelphia, et cetera, I got to go get the consent of the people in that community, and they have to drive it. They have to set the agenda. They have to be not at the kiddie table, but at the main table deciding where resources are going to be distributed. Entirely too many communities where, frankly, white folks with shallow, if any, connection to the communities, all of a sudden are dropping in, opening schools, and local community people with the capacity to really drive achievement aren't a part of that. Not only is that a mistake, first and foremost, for kids, because I'm very clear that experienced, community-based people, frankly, can run schools, frankly, better than many of the young people who came in and out of the blue are trying to run schools in these cities, and at worst can do at least the same type of quality job these new people could do if they had the same resources, I might add, as well. So number one, it's bad for kids. Number two, it's a political disaster. Because the brand for this work becomes totally toxic because local communities, rightfully so, will just see that as another extension of the kind of colonialism that particularly people of color are used to. Used to people coming into communities, doing what it is they want to do under the name that we think is better for you, but you're going to just have to react to what we do. You're not going to be an author of it. You're going to be the kind of object of what it is that others have initiated. Very well-intentioned, but there's been many policy initiatives that have been well intentioned, but that in execution caused more problems than they needed to.
How do you defend charter schools in a context where there are other groups like the NAACP who have been very clear that they think that charter schools are damaging communities of color? And then there are people like you who think that charter schools can do really positive, amazing things for kids. How do you talk about charter schools in a context where there's such a divide?
Well, we just talk about one. First, we support the parents' right to decide, not me, not the NAACP. We believe that the charter should be an option, but that the parent should decide where they want to send their baby. Parents repeatedly support that by the fact that they're continuing to send their kids to public charter schools. And frankly, I don't have any problem saying where I disagree with people. My first job as a lawyer was at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. I litigated some of the DSAG cases. Probably 90% of the things they do, I wholeheartedly agree with. I disagree with them on this issue. And I unapologetically stand with scores of millions of black parents and parents of color and some low-income white parents who want this option for their families. I then reference the Credo study, which has shown that for black students in particular, we talk about in the context of NAACP, although their work is broader, black students and Latino students receive many, many more days of learning in terms of reading and math in the public charter schools in the largest cities in this country. And the reality is, there's very few members of the NAACP who will send their kids to the schools that low-income black and brown kids, families generally restricted to. And so my response generally is if options are good for everybody else, why are they not good enough for low-income families of color? Why should they be restricted to a school that we know hasn't worked for many decades? Why is it problematic for them to have options? And furthermore, do we not believe in them? Do we not believe they know how to make decisions? Right? Because what the moratorium says is we know better than you. We don't even want you to have the choice because we've decided that we don't think these are choices that should be available to you. I actually believe in black parents and families, and I believe in their capacity to make judgment about what's good for their own babies.
One of the last sort of policy questions is there's also disagreement in the sort of reform space about sort of the integration question. And there's some people like the Howard Fullers who, you know, that takes a very strong stance on it. But I wanted to ask you, since we have you here, what's your take on integration as a public policy perspective?
Yeah, you know, I think in theory, I think integration is a great thing for all kids of all cultures, because there's so many stereotypes, there's so much racial misunderstanding, so much misunderstanding across other domains, whether it's class, whether it's sexual orientation, whether it's immigration status, religion. And I think it's always good for kids to be in diverse environments, because they can then realize the universality of the human spirit and also respect cultural differences in a way that I think can build community and build a kind of civic cohesion that I don't think we have. So theoretically, I think it's awesome. But then I look at the reality of our country's history. And I look at the reality of, for example, white supremacy. And I look at the reality that the schools are segregated because white folk don't want to be, don't have their kids educated around black and brown kids. Right? That's what our history has taught us. And so I'm not one who's going to force somebody, who's going to force my kids on folk who tell me they don't want them. And then I'm going to drop my two children off, or the kids in my community, into a school where folk are telling me by their actions that they don't want them. And so my view, and we have deep, for that reason as well, we have deep residential segregation. So the public charter, because I've heard some people say, well, the charters there tend to have overwhelmingly black or brown student populations. And that's for the simple fact that they tend to focus in those communities that are have the most educational disadvantages, which are residentially segregated communities, which are overwhelmingly black and brown folks. In the southward of Newark, where I grew up and still live now, ain't no white folks there. They just ain't there. So if you're going to open up a school there, you're going to be serving the black people in that community. Why are the white people not there? Because they left 40 years ago after the riots, because they didn't want to be in a community with too many black people. So the idea that we're going to compel these folk to want to educate our kids, then drop our kids off in those type of institutions, to me, is irrational. And I just don't have the confidence or belief that folk who tell me they don't want to educate my kids will do so at a high level. So in any event, so that's my view. So I think in theory, it's beautiful. And if somebody could show me there's a particular context where we will have this sort of this love for kids of color and love for black kids and a deep belief in their capacity, I'm all for it. But I suspect what will happen is what we've seen. Because we have these white supremacist ideas about the capacity of black kids, what do we see in facially integrated schools? And I say facially because it's just schools that have kids of various racial backgrounds in it, but there's not true integration. What do we see? We see the black and brown kids tracked to the remedial classes. We see the black and brown kids disproportionately sent to the child study team and classified as having a special ed, generally behavioral disabilities. What do we see? We see the black and brown kids suspended and expelled at higher rates, fueling the school-to-prison pipeline. What do we see? We see lower graduation rates, lower proficiency rates. And so in any event, until somebody can show me that an integrated school will be truly integrated so that we won't have these sort of outcomes, I'm about educating our kids wherever they are at the highest level.
Consider you a friend of the pod. Thanks for coming.
Thank
today.
You. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate Boom.
You. Thank you.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for joining us today on Pod Save That People. Make sure that you tune back in on Tuesday and tell a friend and rate us on iTunes. Thanks.